It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. If any place needs a sports hall of fame, it is Alaska. Our athletes do the impossible, and we need to remember and celebrate their accomplishments. For the last 10 years, that has been happening. And you can see the pictures and text about Alaska's best athletes in an actual hall at the Anchorage Airport. What's really special is that with this anniversary, many of these extraordinary people are getting together to support the Hall of Fame. Very cool, and they'll all be at the same place where you can meet them, and we could not pass up that opportunity to get some of them in our studio to talk about their accomplishments. So we're going to be doing that on today's show, and my first guest is the person we have to thank for that. Harlow Robinson is the founder of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame and has been bringing these athletes together and running this program for the last 10 years. Thanks for being with us, Harlow.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Charles. Thanks for having me.
So, tell me, 10 years, you've accomplished a lot with this thing, and you've had this annual ceremony, and you recognize these folks, and now you're bringing them sort of all back together in one place, which is like a unique event that has never happened before.
Right. No, I think it's historic, and I don't think it'll happen again. I don't. Well, who knows? Maybe we'll do a 20-year celebration. But yeah, it's pretty exciting to. We don't spend a lot of time looking back with our work, our data. You know, we're always looking ahead to the next class of inductees, et cetera.
Yeah.
But there's something. There's something really, momentous about 10 years. So, we want to celebrate what we've done and achieved by kind of honoring, these people, moments, events that are significant in our, not just our sports history, but our culture and heritage in Alaska. So,
yeah,
we're really excited about bringing them all together in one room.
So, and this is there'll be an actual opportunity for just members of the public to go meet some of these legends. Thursday, July 28th, a community event, which is free at the Alaska Airlines Center on the UA campus from 6 to 9 p.m. And if you guys are having trouble remembering these dates, you can find everything on our website, alaskapublic.org, and there'll be a link to Harlow's website at the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. And then you're going to have an actual banquet and induction ceremony the next night at the airport where people can buy tickets. So who are some of the folks that are going to be there that the public can come out and meet and get an autograph?
Yeah, it's a pretty impressive list. I could read the whole list, but I'll just rattle off a couple of the names. I mean, we have some of our Olympic legends, Tommy Moe, Hillary Lind, Nina Kempel, some of our more mainstream athletes like Scott Gomez and Mark Schlereth, Mario Chalmers, some of our kind of Alaskan traditional sport athletes like Reggie Jewell, Alaska Native Games athlete, and some, mushers like Lance Mackey. And we have our annual awards, the Athlete of the Year, what we call the Pride of Alaska Award. So Dallas Seavey will be there to receive his, and Allie Ostrander. Yeah, I could go on and on. I should mention this year's inductees, Don Clary and Janae Deloach, the Olympic long jumper. So those they comprise the two people in the class of 2016. So those are just a few. It's a really long list.
Yeah, that's so cool. So just as you're listing those names, I'm thinking of all kinds of questions at once, but as you're listing those names, I'm forced to think like, wow, this place has turned out a lot of amazing people, right? I mean, you're talking about, NFL, NBA, mushing, skiing, cross-country skiing, just all the lists, some just great athletes.
I know, there's no debate. Really, I've spent quite a bit of time looking at what other states do to honor their, more than half of the states have a state sports hall of fame. And I guarantee you there's no state that's as diverse and rich in their sports history. Certainly you look at, say, in Alabama, and they have an amazing history, but it's all kind of, that baseball, basketball, and football, and real traditional. And, you look at Alaska, and it covers the whole gamut from some really unique sports that are pretty unique to the Arctic or to Alaska, like the Alaska Native Games and mountaineering, et cetera, to the more mainstream sports.
Yeah. And you know, you part of your nonprofit is the Healthy Futures Project, where you're trying to inspire kids to be active and get outdoors, which I think we all realize is really important. And this is kind of part of the inspiration, isn't it, having heroes?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a product of the system. I grew up, you know, as someone that really benefited from what's positive about sports. You know, I didn't become a professional athlete, but I learned all those important lessons that sports teach you. And, you know, I think when we put this organization together, certainly honoring athletes, et cetera, was important. But I think the most important thing is we create a positive resource for the community that promotes the importance of being active, but also, you know, there are a lot of values that sports teach you. So our Healthy Futures program has allowed us to reach engage the community in a really great way. We've got about 20,000 kids statewide that participate, and you know, it's just one thing. There's a lot of issues with children now, right. And the importance of, you know, there's the obesity epidemic.
Right.
There are a lot of issues that I think are really critical right now, and the Healthy Futures program has certainly been one way to reach those kids.
Well, I like how the positive aspect of celebrating these great athletes and looking up to them, using them as a role model, it's probably a lot more effective than telling kids, like, get off the couch, get out of here.
Right. That was I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the link. And that's, you know, athletes as a role. I know Charles Barkley once famously said, you know, I'm an athlete, I'm not a role model, but, you know, he's wrong. I mean, you are, whether you like it or not.
Right.
If you're a public figure, you have a stage, and you do have a responsibility. And I'm really grateful that, you know, the people that we've inducted into the Hall of Fame without fail have really been quality characters and excited to help us with our Healthy Futures program, show up at races, kids events, and hand out medals, talk to the kids. You know, we have a lot of great quality characters among our
inductees. That's very true. Yeah,
so.
I can't think of any sort of like anybody who has a bad reputation on that list, right? They're all known as being good guys.
So, and I should note, you know, when we induct people, our kind of metric that is, obviously it's really hard to compare, say, a mountaineer to a basketball player and try to figure out whose criteria and credentials are more worthy. But the metric we use is pride and positive distinction that person has brought to the state of Alaska. So
I love that. That's
so character
great.
Counts, you know. But I'm grateful. Looking back at 10 years, that we don't have anyone on the wall that we're
haven't had to take any pictures
thoughts.
Down. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. So 10 years, pretty big accomplishment for you, I think. How did it come about that you took on this challenge of forming this, and obviously of stuck with it? You obviously have a lot of responsibility for it, but how did you get this thing off the ground?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, certainly it was not just me. There are a lot of people that, you know, once I had an idea, and it's not a new idea. I mean, I think other people have thought of it before, but at some point you get to that, well, why not me stage, where if you want to see something happen, you realize, you know, maybe you need to be the one. But there are a lot of people that share the same passions I do. So it wasn't hard to put a great board of directors together and find some funders. And you know, then it becomes a owned by the community and not just me. So, you know, I think the hardest part was the getting the concept down and building the, you know, writing the bylaws and meeting people to get them, talk them into being on one more board of directors.
Right.
But, you know, we've had this almost the same group of, we've added some directors over the years, but just about every one of them says it's the most fun they've ever had
I'm
on a board
sure.
before.
Yeah.
So it's really rewarding, and, you know, what's not to like? And It's not political. It's not it's not controversial. It's 100%
it's something
positive, just about
right?
Everyone in Alaska, whether you're a sports fan or not, there's something to like about it.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So how do you choose these folks? Because that's got to be the hardest part of this whole thing.
Right.
I mean, I can think of so many people who could be worthy in some way of being honored.
Yeah, for sure. And first thing I'll say is I don't. And that was one of the really tricky aspects of our bylaws, and we wanted something that was as objective and fair as humanly possible. Our board of directors and myself, as a executive director, we have no say in who gets inducted, other than kind of approving the slate of recommendations from the selection panel. So we have 9 people from around the state, and they're, you know, I would say they're as good of a, you know, a group, an authoritative group of experts as we could possibly come up with that, you know, covers different realms of sports, different geographical locations of the state. And then we also have a 10th ballot, and that is our public. And so every fall in November, we have the public voting that happens. So that panel, they come into Anchorage and they sit around a big table and they throw out all the names and they have a real robust debate. And my job is to sit there and not say a word and just kind of oversee. And yeah, it's tough. There are a lot of people that just miss. There are a lot of people that, there are a lot of selection panel members that feel strongly about one person, but you know they all are for the greater good. And I do hear from the public. I'm the one that hears when someone does not get in, and I could list probably 10 names right now that there are passionate groups that are, you know, hopeful that they get inducted and disappointed when they don't. And all I can say is that we chose to be exclude, you know, have a very elite group on the wall, and we're the Hall of Fame and not the Hall of Very Good. And I feel like there are some candidates still out there that are very worthy, and I'm going to put my faith in that panel.
So do you just take nominations from the public, or how do you choose who is actually going to be a candidate?
So there is on our website, there is a page of all the inductee candidates that basically the very first year of our election, we had an open ballot to the public, and we had probably over 1,000 people just submit their top 5 lists, so to speak. And so out of that was built our nomination page. So every following year of the voting, people go to our nomination page and rank their top 5 choices. But there is also one write-in option, so that allowed for new names to enter the wall, the conversation, so that nomination page was fluid and names get added. But so that's been the process. It's really fun to go and look at that page and see some of the potential
for
future
sure.
nominees.
Yeah, so it's not like the Baseball Hall of Fame where you're up for a vote a few times. If you don't make it, you're
no.
like excluded forever.
I will say, though, it's difficult, though, because we don't have, say, with the baseball committee, they have a veterans committee, and there were a lot of decisions we made early on, and then we want to be consistent with them. One of them is, you know, a veterans committee would be nice, but then you didn't want to do anything to diminish someone's, you know, the getting inducted. We didn't want someone to come in on a veterans committee as opposed to just being one of the inductees on the wall. So, but that does really challenge our selection panel to do their research. And you look back at an Iron Man, Jack Johnson. I'm forgetting his name now. There you go. But, you know, he's an old sweepstakes musher from the 1920s, example. So
you really need to do some historical research to figure out who those folks are and bring them forward and then make your case. But that's all part of the fun, right?
It is part of the fun.
It's not like there's anything bad going to happen if somebody doesn't get it on all five.
No, other than, you know, someone feeling or a group feeling like they were omitted. But we're doing our best. And a good example of that, Wally Leisk, he's inducted into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. I'd never heard of the guy before, but Southeast Alaska certainly had, especially the old timers. And, you know, when we got organized, they made a very compelling case for him being inducted. And I would say most of our panel had never even heard the name as well. And a gentleman in Sitka organized a petition and had 2,000 signatures on it and a huge box of old newspaper clippings. And the guy was
a basketball player?
Yeah, it turns out he was a star in the 40s. I mean, long before Trajan Langdon or any others were even born. And he led the Seattle University to the University of Washington, to the Elite Eight, and he would have played in the NBA if he hadn't opted to join the fly in World War II and then raise a family. So there are a lot of great stories.
So he's a real hero, actually.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah,
that is so cool. Well, you know what? We're already out of time, and we've got some Hall of Fame members, inductees coming in who I want to save plenty of time to talk to. But I really want to thank you, Harlow. This is such a great thing you've done, and really is an important thing for Alaskans that we can appreciate these folks who've done these great accomplishments and really inspire us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Charles. I could talk all day.
I know. We could do the whole day of a whole show just of us rapping about like who should be and who shouldn't. So the event of the big community event is coming up Thursday, July 28th. That's going to be at the Alaska Airlines Center at UAA, and anybody can come. Just come and meet. Basically, almost the entire Alaska Sports Hall of Fame is going to be there. All these folks who've done these amazing accomplishments. Bring your kids, get autographs and pictures taken at 6 to 9 p.m. on Thursday the 28th. And then the banquet and induction ceremony for the 10th anniversary of the Hall of Fame is Friday, July 29th. Still time to get tickets to that. You can find them on the website for the Hall of Fame, which you can also access through our website at outdoorexplorer.org. And thanks very much, Harlow Robinson. Thanks for doing this, and thanks for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame, which is it is an actual hall, but it's also a really, really great way to honor and recognize Alaskan athletes. Of course, we're particularly thinking about outdoor athletes on today's show, but all kinds of athletes. And as we heard from Harlow Robinson, the founder of the Hall of Fame, it's an extraordinary range of accomplishments that are honored. And right now, I'm really pleased to have a new inductee to the Hall of Fame. Don Clary is going to be joining the Hall of Fame in the ceremony that's coming up, and is someone who was a tremendous runner in the 70s and 80s, made it to the Olympics, long-distance runner, set many of our records, and is a name who, if you were around, actually for a pretty long span of time in Alaska, is a familiar name to you because he was in the newspaper all the time. And just delighted that you could be here, Don.
Thank you.
So you started out running at the junior high level and right here in Anchorage at Wendler Junior High. And I'm always, when I talk to elite athletes, I'm always curious to find out how the spark caught that made you know that you had both had talent and you wanted to utilize that talent and take it to the most exalted level.
Well, I probably have to give some credit to my parents. When I was younger, before junior high, they encouraged me to try all sorts of sports, and I did everything from baseball to wrestling to air rifle, target shooting, basketball, and through trying out all of these different sports, you kind of get a knack to where you excel. And, you know, a lot of them are running oriented. And in gym class at Wendler Junior High in seventh and eighth grade, they'd have the track and field portions of gym class in the spring, and it seemed like I would always excel in those time trials or those races. You know, they're very informal, but some of my classmates.
I'm pretty fast.
Well, some of my classmates noticed, and I wasn't going out for those sports on an organized level, encouraged me to try out. So in ninth grade, I did go out for the cross-country team and end up winning every race I ran in cross-country, and then same in track. So the spark was developed once I had this success, and, you know, you get some recognition for it. It's positive reinforcement, and that really... That helped me continue with it. And the challenge for me was, you know, I looked at what the state records were in the various events, and I guess I was very self-motivated because those were the challenges that kept me training and spurred me to continue on with my career in high school.
It's interesting that you had this obvious physical talent from day one. It wasn't something that where you were sort of... developed, or somebody said, "Don, we want you to be a runner." You went out and ran, and you were winning from day one. And then you developed the drive to take that to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I look back on my youthful days, I can kind of see where I had that talent. Not totally recognizing it at the time, but now I have this long range perspective, and looking back on my career, I can see that, you know, I had a natural gift for running, and so I say I was fortunate that I had the motivation, the coaching to, you know, give me that reinforcement and continue with the career. I've seen a lot of athletes, some very successful, others who had a lot of talent but didn't quite have that success. So, you know, there's no roadmap and things, there's pitfalls along the way. So I feel fortunate that...
it's not given to you for sure. Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
So what are the qualities that make physically make a long-distance runner? I mean, obviously, there's some people who could work really hard and be pretty good at it, but there's only a very small group who can, you know, be the very best. And what are sort of the attributes that make give you that the assets that you can get to that very top level?
I would probably say your cardiovascular system, you know, your heart and your lungs. You don't have to be very strong to be a runner. You can just see some of the top athletes at this time who are competing, and those guys are rail thin, but they've got engines on them. They're like long-distance Volkswagens. They're not like the sprinters who are the Cadillacs.
Yeah.
So I would say that was probably where my talent was. I had a good cardiovascular system, ability to recover quickly through interval training. And, you know, my physical appearance, I'm not rail thin like a lot of runners. I probably would have been a pretty good cross-country skier. I never chose to go out for that sport. It just wasn't as popular as it is today.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I might have been more structurally suited for that sport because I have a little bit more muscularity to me than a lot of distance runners. But for me, it was really my heart and my lungs, I think, that really where my talents lied.
Yeah. What about the psychological heart? I mean, because in distance running, unlike sprinting, you've got to tough it out and keep pushing. And if you don't have that mental endurance, you're not really going to be successful, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. The mental aspect of it, you know, the motivation, the goal setting and the motivation to reach those goals is a big factor too. But, you know, going out every day and training and also racing, you know, the mental aspect of it is very important. And I think that's probably what defeats a lot of athletes. I think a lot of athletes can prepare physically, but it's the mental component that really is the hard one to control.
Yeah.
Because you're just not, there's always a fear of failure, I think, in the back of your mind. And those athletes that can set that aside and just lay it on the line, whatever sport it might be, you know, I think probably 9 times out of 10, they surprise themselves and you know, they achieve their goal.
Yeah.
And that fear of failure is just something that kind of is a weight on your shoulders.
Kind of can rob you, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and having good good coaching and good training partners. I mean, I enjoyed the folks that I trained with and my fellow teammates, and they're motivators too. So it's not like you're always out there by yourself toiling away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's fun, right? It becomes your social world.
Sure.
Yeah. So you had some extraordinary success in as a runner in your high school level in Alaska, and you're already in the Alaska High School Hall of Fame. Set tons of records. Tell us about that part of your life. You're really developing your identity as a runner, but then also having huge success.
Yeah, that was the stepping stone that got me to college and then from there to the national level. But in high school, that was the foundation. And I guess I was on a fast track. I mean, I didn't start running until ninth grade. And if you can imagine the cross-country races at Wendler, my ninth grade year, I think the distances were 1 mile, 1.25 miles, and 1.5 miles, three consecutive weekends out at Campbell Airstrip. Huh. And if you can imagine, that's the longest distance you're running. And, you know, now you're in ninth grade, you're in high school, you're a freshman, and the distances are 5K, they're 3 miles. So it was a very, I wouldn't say progressive time. It was just that we hadn't developed our programs to that high a level. And then in high school, till I was a senior, you couldn't run two races over a quarter mile in any one meet. So, for instance, you couldn't run the mile and the 2 mile, which back then were on the same day. So I would run the mile and then the quarter mile and maybe do the relay. So,
and we're talking now about the early 1970s.
Yeah, well, that would be 1973, 74. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got to be a senior, the rules had changed. They allowed you to double, as what we called it. And so, you know, I was running more races. But it was each year, the challenges, I was improving my times. Mm-hmm. You know, what I did last year, I wanted to improve on the next year. And that was my motivating factor. And I had good coaches that gave me good workouts that allowed me to progress.
Kind of a supportive community.
Mm-hmm. And so by the time I was a senior, you know, I was achieving times that kids in the lower 48 were achieving. And I had the opportunity to run in the World Junior Cross Country Championships when I was a senior in high school. And they were in Rabat, Morocco. And that was the second time I'd ever run outside the state of Alaska. The race was an 8K race.
Wow.
And never run that distance before, but I ended up getting fifth in that race.
And in Morocco, where the temperature must have been a factor too, huh?
Yeah, it was. In March, it wasn't extremely hot, but it was totally different than what we were dealing with here. But that race and...
So fifth in the world, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and that's one of the races that probably helped... get me some recognition on the national level for you know, colleges. Mm-hmm. Because when you're running up here, they have no clue as to what the conditions are, whether your times are accurate. But when you're running on an international stage, you know, that's the proof.
So. Right, right. So then you got recruited to the University of Oregon, which was the best and probably still the best track and field sort of mecca in the United States. And sort of the legendary Steve Prefontaine had been there and and is still like the saint of Eugene, you know, his picture is everywhere, but he just tragically had died.
He died in May of 75, which was the year I graduated, and I went to Oregon that fall. So his legacy, as it still is, but it was even more raw and part of the culture down there because, you know, 4 months before that, before I went down there, you know, he'd been running races in Eugene. So the track and field community down there is very strong, and it is a mecca for running. And if I had the choice, I'd go there. You know, I mean, this day and age, they've had some lulls in where the teams haven't been as good, but running in Eugene, Oregon in general, I mean, it's a great atmosphere.
Yeah, and so you got into the 5,000 there in the steeplechase, and were you a standout from that team right away?
My first fall down there, I didn't do as well as I had hoped. Had an injury, so I redshirted my cross-country season, but then I trained through the winter, and then in track that spring, actually was in a dual meet against Washington State where I was running the 5K and had the opportunity to run against who was probably considered one of the best runners in the world at that time, John Nano, and he was the defending NCAA champion. And in that race, I ended up defeating him and ran a time that I'm pretty sure still is one of the top 10 times ever run by a a U.S. junior in the 5K. They don't keep those records. You can find the world list, but I've looked in the past, and so that time still stands up. And
I just, before you go on, you've obviously, you've got a great opportunity to run against one of the world's best runners, mm-hmm. two-man competition. Sort of what goes through your mind that allows you to perform and take it to that next level? Is it like the excitement of competition? Is it just you just do what you do and you and it comes out? Or give me the sort of the mental space that you're in when you have that kind of performance.
I think it, if I remember with that race, it's trying to be as relaxed as you can.
Mm.
I know when I haven't been as relaxed, I'm not quite as successful. And I think when you're relaxed, it's that fear of failure kind of goes away.
I mean,
you know, you're not thinking about that. All you're thinking about is the race itself. And, you know, your body has to be in sync, too. There's not every race you're going to be in sync mentally and physically. In that particular race, I was, and it was a lousy day. I mean, it was raining hard, windy. So you wouldn't expect that kind of performance. But it was one of my most memorable races, aside from making the Olympic team.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking to Don Clary, who's about to be inducted into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. And from just our conversation we've had so far, you can tell why. And Don is from Anchorage. He's still in Anchorage and just had an amazing running career through high school in Alaska and through college at University of Oregon, then internationally. And you kind of after college, you became a club runner and continued to run internationally. And sort of always working and thinking about the Olympics and moving up to that next level.
Mm-hmm.
I always think that's interesting for a young person because when you're performing at that level, you've got this opportunity. On the other hand, there's a lot you give up, right? Mm-hmm. To really focus your whole life on your sport.
You do give up a lot. And basically a training week for me was you run twice a day, Monday through Saturday. And Sundays, your long run. So every day you're training. You basically aren't going camping. You're not going skiing. You're not doing a lot of other things that other individuals do. And yeah, it has to be that way. I mean, you know, you're not spending 8 hours a day exercising, but you know, you need recovery time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really becomes your life. And ideally, after I got out of when I graduated. At the University of Oregon, took a year off and stayed down in Eugene and then went back to graduate school. And the college regimen class schedule is an ideal one for an athlete, I think. You make your own schedule, you go to classes, you've got the time to set aside, and you can really schedule things around your training, which is paramount.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the first thing in the morning was to go for the run. And so that's first and foremost in your mind before you're doing anything else.
So when you're doing that and competing at that level, are you thinking goal-oriented? I've got to get to the Olympics. I want to get to the Olympics. Or are you just sort of enjoying what you're doing a little bit along the way? How do you conceptualize your goals when you're competing at that level?
Well, the Olympics are the goal, but mm-hmm. You know, they're only every 4 years. So in those off years, you know, you set goals, but there's other competitions, and there's always trying to improve your times, and each year, you know, get better and keep progressing. That's the key. And interspersed with that are the international competitions. It would be typical in the summer to go over to Europe. There's a track circuit over there with a schedule of races early summer to late fall, and gives you an opportunity to compete against international athletes and, you know, test yourself and hopefully learn from those experiences and gain the confidence, you know, to compete at that high level. And aside from the fact that you're getting to travel to these countries and visit them and see other mm-hmm. cultures, that's kind of a side.
What a treat, yeah.
Exactly.
What a privilege.
All of the travel I got was one of the side benefits of the competitions. And
oh, I imagine, so. Yeah. So you made it to the Olympics in 1984 in L.A., which was a huge Olympics because it was here in the United States and so many other things about it. Was that the crowning achievement that you were hoping for? Was it? Tell me about that experience and how it fit in with the rest of your career.
Actually, making the team, the Olympic trials was probably, I mean, I ran very, very well there. I ran the also ran in the 10,000, but I ended up finishing seventh or eighth in the final. So I didn't make that the team in the 10, but I had a day off, and then the 5,000 started. And you would have thought, after not having success in this earlier event, that it might not bode well for the 5,000, which was over the next 4 days, three races. But as I mentioned with the race earlier, when I was a freshman at Oregon, it seemed like, you know, kind of a weight was lifted off my shoulders. That fear of failure was not there. I was just very relaxed. And when I was in that state, you know, I was just running and not really thinking about much else. Mm-hmm. And I ended up running in the first round in the semifinals, the fastest heat times I think that anybody's ever run in the trials.
Wow.
And I don't know if those times still hold up, but I had a couple of athletes ask me why I was running so fast. Well, it didn't seem to me I was. I mean, I was just, my mind and my body were in sync.
Mm.
And so with the 5,000, completely different mental aspect and feeling. And then when the final came around, on that last day, I ended up finishing third. You know, the goal was be in the top three. And that race, our last three laps, we were on sub 4 minute mile pace.
Wow.
For the last four laps or three laps in there. If I could add another lap, maybe I would have run a sub 4 mile in a 5,000.
That's incredible.
But that's the kind of training, you know, that you had to develop over the intervening years, because the 5,000, it is one distance, but it's a multiple races when you get to the Olympics. And so in the Olympics, I didn't have a good competition. I made it to the semifinals, but in that race, I was never really in contention, and thought about it a lot. But you know, you're going to have those days. And
yeah.
Thought I'd have another opportunity in 1988. I did qualify for the trials, but I ended up not competing because of an injury. And that was the last time I qualified.
Came back to Anchorage, went into a career in banking, and kept running in our local races, and obviously didn't have too much effort to win a lot of races after what you had done. But then, you know, your running career is over now because of some joint issues. And without getting into all the details of that, I'm just interested in the adjustment for someone for whom running has been so important in your life, to moving to a period like when you're not running anymore. That must be really tough.
It is. It's a transition. I did have an advantage in that right now I do a lot of stationary biking and I do circuit training. But biking has always been an exercise I've enjoyed, and I've used it in the past when I was in my prime and I was injured. So, you know, I've developed workouts that I do with that particular type of exercise. It's not the same as running, but the adjustment, and it was a slow adjustment. I never really, wasn't like the light was shut off, the switch was shut off. I mean, I didn't realize I wasn't going to be able to continue running, and the injury I had was ended up causing me to have hip replacement surgery. So it was a slow transition. It wasn't so abrupt. And for me, I was fortunate. If I was going to have an injury like that, it wasn't in the prime of my career.
Yeah,
I was, you know, getting into my early 40s. And you know, it's for me, as long as I can exercise in some form or fashion, that's an important thing for me.
Yeah.
And I'm still motivated to do that, even though it's not running.
Yeah. So tell me how you feel about being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Oh, it's an honor. You know, it's you know, we're going to be joining an elite club, and there's lots of individuals who have had many different accomplishments across a broad spectrum of sports. So it's an opportunity to this
especially
July,
this time when they're all going to be there, because it's the 10th anniversary.
Yep, and so there'll be a lot of voices, names I'm familiar with who I haven't met. I'll have that opportunity, and the Hall of Fame, you know, recognizing athletes across this broad range of sports is interesting, because you learn things. I know there's been some athletes from earlier days in Alaska's history. Basketball comes to mind for one. And so, you know, I didn't realize those people existed.
Oh,
so you learn something.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Well, and people in the future are going to learn about you, too. Oh, that's pretty cool, right?
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Part of Alaska history now. Don Clary, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Don is an amazing runner. He's going to be inducted to the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame on their 10th anniversary, which is coming up. Stick with us. That's our topic for the whole hour today on Outdoor Explorers. Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we are talking about the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame and talking with some Sports Hall of Famers. There's so many that we could talk to who've done such amazing things, and I chose a couple who are from Anchorage and who are endurance athletes and have participated in all kinds of stuff locally and internationally. We heard from Don Clary before, and now I've got Bill Spencer in the studio, who is had an amazing sports career and whose name lives on on the Spencer Loop, which is one of our best ski trails in town. And he's responsible for designing some of our very, very best trails. Bill's a civil engineer as well as being an athlete. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I just want to go over a little bit of your resume for those who just showed up in town and don't know about all the things you've done. Bill set a record from the junior race in the Mount Marathon in 1973, which still stands. Nobody's beaten his record in 43 years. Amazing. And a senior record, which he set in 81, stood in just a few years ago. He went to the Olympics in Calgary as a cross-country skier, coached a national champion team at University of Vermont, also coached at UAA for years, and did all this trail design and building. I asked the same question of Don when he was in here. When did you realize that you had some particular talent in this kind of endurance sports? What was did a light bulb go off at some point?
Yeah, when you're that young, I don't think you're really looking at it that way. You know, it just sort of evolves. I remember my sister and I heard about this race in Seward and decided we'd go down and give that a try. When I was about 15, she was 2 years older than I was, and we went down there and showed up, didn't have any idea what we were getting into, but just sort of got hooked on it, and then kept coming back. And then I started thinking, well, yeah, maybe I could beat that record for the juniors. So I went after that, and then after that I was a senior, won the first year of the first year that I tried the senior race. I won that as well and set a new record in the senior race. It's always been a love-hate relationship with the Seward race. It's so hard on your body that after you get done with it, you swear you'll never do it again until the next year rolls around, and then you're training for it again.
Yeah. So were you doing cross-country running in school, or were you training? How did you sort of get to where you knew that you were going to be good at that?
Actually, I was an alpine skier. Grown up alpine skiing in Independence Mine,
yeah, I remember that. Yeah, there's a rope tow there.
Yeah, a rope tow there, Summit Lake, Turnigan Pass. My parents were really involved in skiing, and so had done that. And then I got into bike racing, and in high school, I remember Tom Corbin was the coach there at Service High School, one of my mentors and a great coach. Talked me into going out for the running team and had pretty good success there. And he may have sort of pushed me to go down to Mount Marathon too. I can't really remember exactly how that worked out, but I went down and gave it a try. It was fun. And I was good at it. So
yeah,
I was a really small kid. Probably didn't make more than about 5'3" when I graduated from high school. So that was pretty ideal for running mountains. And
you don't have to carry all that much mass up the mountain.
I was carrying less than 100 pounds, I think, when I won that senior race the first year. So
wow. It always strikes me that there's fitness in that race, and then there's balance and daring on the way down. And the year that Eric Strable finally beat your record, which was just a few years ago, he wasn't even the first one to the top, right? But he's such an amazing skier and has such amazing balance that he beat everybody down. And so maybe your alpine skiing helped with that too.
Yeah, there's a good chance all that time standing on slippery boards on steep slopes had something to do with that.
How long did you keep racing Mount Marathon?
Well, I'm gonna go do it this year.
Oh, you are? Okay, so you're still at it.
20th time. I took about 15 years off in the middle there, but when my kids got back into it, I started racing it again, and I'm gonna go down, give it at least one more year.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you still ski race too?
A little bit. It's all just for fun now. I go out and support my kids and watch them, they're doing pretty well in the mountain racing, and I'm just back there bringing up the back of the pack.
Uh-huh. So your route to the Olympics was a little bit unusual because your older. You weren't you didn't go straight from college.
I got pretty involved in skiing right out of high school and tried to make a couple of the earlier Olympic teams, got sick at trials, things didn't turn out very well, and eventually sort of bagged the idea and went off to get a degree at Montana State. And after I got my degree there, I stayed there and coached for a couple of years at Montana. And standing on the sidelines watching other people race, I realized that I really had something more that I wanted to do there, so I got back into it. And then trained for another 5 years and went to the Calgary Olympics. So
it's a story kind of like Holly Brooks, where she kind of quit and then coaching stayed at a very pretty high fitness level, enough that she was able to kind of jump back into it. Yes?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And she probably would concur that you really don't learn how to ski until you start teaching other people to do it. And then technically it really helps you when you've analyzed it that much. Your own technique improves quite a bit. And
interesting, because you're watching them and you're looking at every little fault, and then you notice it in yourself.
Yeah, you tear it all down and look at it. And of course, then you still have the bug. Then you're watching them race and you realize, I'm not quite done here yet.
Well, that's so interesting about skiing and technique, because it's a pretty dramatic difference from running, where it feels like fitness is really, 99.9%, and not leaving out psychology, of course, which is also really important. But in skiing, the technique, you could be the fittest guy in the race and still lose if you don't have the best technique.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
I mean, what percentage do you think you gain, that elite athlete, are they looking at, the coaching is going to give them a tenth of a percent, or are they, I've heard it said that, somebody could gain 10% who's already a really good skier by improving their technique. And I always wonder if that's true. Then the other thing is that technique seems to change through the years so much, right? There's always sort of differences in how you do it.
Yeah, when I've watched, I get on now trying to help my kids improve their technique and watch videos of the World Cup skiers, they're definitely skiing quite a bit differently than we were back then. There's a lot more power involved. There's a lot more upper body strength. We were sort of transitioning out of strictly classic skiing and picking up skating as it came onto the scene. So we were powering it more with our legs, and I think now they're probably have shifted out of that a little bit. But percentage wise, that's a pretty tough one to put your number on. It's I've always had this theory that it's impossible to not learn how to ski if you do it enough. We always had this saying that the technique was really in the snow. And if you run over it enough with your skis, eventually it seeps into your core and gets into your body, and then you learn how to do it. So,
So which was your true love? Was it cross country skiing or mountain running?
I like them all. I think I really fell in love with the training and the backcountry experience of Alaska, and the competition is more of an excuse to do that, say the running at Mount Marathon is pretty hard on your body, but the training for it is just beautiful, to run Bird Ridge and in the evenings and stuff like that, get out in the backcountry in the Chugach. That was my real love, it was just the competition gave me a socially acceptable reason to do it.
So what would be a training schedule when you were in your best years of running?
I tried a lot of different things. Early on when I was setting those junior records, we were pretty focused, and we would go down. My sister and I would go down and camp out in Dennis, and his name. They own the Alaska shop down there, and they let us camp in their yard, and we would go down there for a couple of weeks and run Mount Marathon twice a day to the halfway point for 2 weeks, and then we'd go and race, which of course is a ludicrous thing to do for training, but it worked.
I guess so.
I used to race bikes in the spring, and then we'd go down and train Mount Marathon sort of really intensely right before it happened. And in my later years, after I got back into ski racing, I would just put on my running shoes and go down there the night before the race and run up the mountain the night before and show up the next morning and race.
Wow.
So there was very little training for it. I was so fit from all my ski training.
And that's what you set your, the record?
No, actually, the year that I set my record, I was still in college.
Okay, and that was earlier.
I spent my spring running in the mountains in Montana and all the high altitude.
Oh, yeah.
That was a pretty good prep for it, too, but... No training on treadmills back in those days.
Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking with members of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame right now, Bill Spencer, who set many records, but his records in the Mount Marathon race lasted decades. I'm always interested when you have like a super standout performance like that, like a record, like your junior record, which is like now 43 years old, and Your other record lasted many decades as well. Do you know that you're having this incredible day? I mean, do you feel like you're elevated above what's normal, or is it just like you're feeling good and you just do it and you look up at the clock and say, wow, that was fast?
Yeah, I think probably the latter.
Yeah.
You definitely know when you're having a good day, and I really noticed that when I was cross-country skiing. Some days you'd go out of the gate and it was a good day and everything was easy and the splits would start coming in and you could see that you were having a really good one. It wasn't a difficult thing. And then other days you just struggled and you knew it was going to be hard, but you still kept pushing. But I don't think back in those early Mount Marathon days that I really had any idea. I was so far ahead of the pack and in that junior race that I didn't even know how I was doing until I got to the finish line.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know that 24 minutes and change was a good performance. There wasn't really anything to compare it to. It was just how I felt that day. So.
Yeah, cool. So you got involved in building ski trails, and Spencer Loop has your name on it, and it's this amazing trail up on the hillside. And then you also worked on the Leakish Loop at Kincaid, two of our most challenging trails. What was the process for deciding how you were going to design those trails? And I mean, as a good skier, you wanted to ski on a tough trail, right? But that wasn't all there was to it.
Yeah, I think both of those trails, and I've designed quite a few trails subsequently for a lot of different types of skiing. But both of those were targeted at the racing community. People came to us with specific wants. You know, we want an Olympic quality trail for the Anchorage area. And the one on the hillside was targeted at junior, high-end junior racing on the international scene. And Jim Galanis and I originally laid it out.
Jim was a big APU coach.
Yeah, he was the APU coach. He and I were both still ski racing at the time. And he got a contract with the city to lay the thing out and brought me in as someone that could find my way around in the woods and not get lost. And so we laid the thing out, figured out the homologation numbers for it, and he subsequently went back to coach at Stratton Mountain School. And
homologation being a word most people wouldn't know, but it has to do with making sure that the trail meets international standards for races.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some fairly specific specifications for the way the trail's laid out, where the hills have to be, how long they can be, how steep they are, things like that, so that it skis pretty well. And the reason I think it ended up with my name on it is he got out of competitive skiing, and I kept in it for a few more years, and he left the state, and people continued to ski that trail, and every time they went up that big hill along the creek, they were looking for somebody to swear at.
Yeah.
And that was me. I was more local.
Yeah, I get that. That hill is the killer.
Yeah, it's that damn Spencer. Wait till we get our hands on him.
If you're starting the 50K Tour of Anchorage, that's where you destroy yourself.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But it's, I mean, when you're a really good skier, having a challenging trail is it makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah, it makes it fun, and if you're going to go and race in those really competitive venues in Europe, you need a place to train that has that same type of terrain. Mm-hmm. That was the target.
It must be fun to watch our skiing community grow and develop to the point where we've got lots of international skiers and people, you know, skiers who are really performing at a really high level.
Yeah, I know it's been amazing for me to watch the way the stuff that we've passed down over the years to the next generation has bloomed, and I'm just blown away by it. It's really amazing.
It is, yeah. Yeah. So your Olympics was 1988 and in Calgary, and it was kind of the dawn of skate skiing. Skate skiing had not been around all that long at that point, right?
Yeah, the first time I was pretty much right there when it started to happen. I think we were on the Scandinavian Polar Cup in the spring of, it was the spring of 1984, and we went to some Polar Cup races, and there was a Norwegian on the Norwegian national team that had been skiing really well, and one day up in Kiruna, it was a wet, sloppy day, clister conditions, the skis were really slow, 30K, and this guy said, you know, we've been skating a lot, let's just go to the start line with no wax on. And that was pretty much the breaking point when somebody finally decided to take the wax off their kick skis and go skate, and he won the race. And
there's no rule against it.
No, there was no rule against it. Then, of course, everybody's light bulb went off in a big way. And then the next season at the World Championships in Seyfeld, I was there also. And I remember walking down to the start for the 30K, I believe it was, and I had a pair of waxed kick skis in one hand and a pair of skate skis in the other. And I got all the way down to the ski marking pin and had to make a decision, which one am I going to take? And I took the skate skis.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't do particularly stellar, but I had a good race. And it was the first time that I'd gone in a big international race with no wax on my skis. And it was, yeah. And then there we were.
Pretty
kept
cool.
Kept going from there.
And that kind of became your specialty.
Yeah, I was a better skater than I was a classic skier. I did both, and of course, most people still do, but I was better skating.
Was making it to the Olympics sort of a crowning achievement, or some of these other accomplishments that you had in Alaska, or you know, what do you look back on as sort of being the thing that you're most proud of?
Good question. I think the thing that I've been most known for, and probably the thing that got me into the Hall of Fame, is probably the Mount Marathon racing. But say most of these experiences are pretty much a reason to get out and train in the mountains, and it's my time in the backcountry and my enjoyment of Alaskan outdoors that has really driven it all. And
it's all about loving Alaska.
Yeah, it's all about the backcountry and what we have here to get out into.
Well, that's a great way to finish it, because hopefully it is all about Alaska and loving the outdoors and why we do all this stuff, and competition is just a way of making it more fun. So thanks so much for being with us, Bill Spencer.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's show. I want to thank Don Clary and Harlow Robinson, who were with us earlier. Check our website at outdoorexplorer.org to learn more about the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame and the big events that are coming up in July. Eric Bork is our producer. Grace Bogine is our production assistant. My name is Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.